promised, can you hear me? I promised him I'd be done at 9:01, so if we can close in the usual manner with the Lord's Prayer. I'd like to first thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity to one more time get better than I deserve and be invited to share this conference with a lot of men that have been here a lot longer than I've ever thought about. I was sitting in a meeting that we had last night, and I was listening to the Al-Anons introduce themselves, and I thought, man, I got less time than any of these guys. So I was digging through my tie trying to hand it off to somebody, you know. Tim also asked me to get as close to the mic as I could, and I told him that I would try. Just future note, get that information out before dinner. And does the photographer have the wide-angle lens on tonight? You know, Al-Anon's been a way of life for me since August 25th of 1996. And I'm a legacy. My father was an Al-Anon for 10 years before he passed away. And he tried for many, many, many years to get me to come. But I was out with my own agenda doing my own thing, and it never made sense to me. I would go to meetings with him, and I would walk into the rooms, and I would see these words up on the walls in needlepoint, and I thought, well, he's going to a needlepoint class, I guess. But it was making him happy, and it was calming him down, and so it made me happy. I was born in Dallas, one of three children. I was the middle child, and for years I would have told you that all my problems surrounded about being a middle child. What I found out through working the steps was it had nothing to do about birth order. It was because I was the middle child, and I was self-will run riot. Now, I will tell you that I grew up in a loving family, had very little alcoholism growing up. I had two uncles, one on each side, that drank heavily. I don't know if they were alcoholics or not. One of them, on my mom's side, was a very jovial drunk, and his name was Uncle Joe. And we grew up in a family clothing business, and in the summertime, the kids would go down there and spend the time. And what a neat deal that I would get to spend the summers with my relatives. And we come from a long line of, we were Lebanese on both sides of my family, so there was a lot of family stuff going on. And you know, every Sunday we'd gather at grandmother's house and spend time with the cousins. And, you know, Uncle Joe was very jovial. He would come pick us up in the morning and take us down to work because my mother didn't have to be there till later. And I remember one time he used to take us to the old Lucas B&B Cafe for breakfast before we'd go to work. And he stopped short one time there on Oak Lawn, and when he did, this bottle rolled out from under the seat. And I didn't think anything about it. I didn't know much about alcoholism at that point or drinking or anything like that. What I did know was he was always smiling, always laughing, always telling jokes. He'd walk around and he'd rattle the change in his pocket all the time. And you could hear Uncle Joe coming from 30, 40 feet away because you'd hear the change coming. And he would tell these funny jokes. But the thing I remember about Uncle Joe is as the day would progress, he would start listing off to one side. And if you were going to follow Uncle Joe, you better start listening too, or you're going to miss a lot of what he was saying. But he was a happy man. Now, I didn't grow up in his family, so I don't know what it was like at home. Because I can assure you that what it was like at home when alcoholism took a hold of my family was a lot different than what people saw. I had another uncle on my dad's side of the family by marriage, and as jovial as Uncle Joe was, Uncle Gene not so much. Uncle Gene, he and my aunt had a house up at Lake Texoma, and he would take us fishing during the day, and about 2:30 in the afternoon, Uncle Gene would disappear, and he'd go to the VFW or the Legion Hall or something, and Uncle Gene would come home about 5:30 or 6, and the beatings would start. He never touched us kids, but we would listen to and watch him beat my aunt mercilessly. And, you know, as jovial as Uncle Joe was, that was a very traumatic thing for us to see as little kids. And as soon as Mom and Dad caught wind of that, that was the last time we went and spent the summer with Uncle Gene. And you know what I can tell you, the common denominator of Uncle Joe and Uncle Gene was that they both died young, and they were both quite jaundiced when they died. But other than that, there really wasn't much drinking going on. We grew up in the 60s and 70s, and, you know, back then we did a lot of partying. And my brothers and I, we all partied together, you know, and it was fun times. I will tell you that my mother, after she had us, spent the next 5 or 6 years in Timberlawn. She had a lot of mental issues. And, you know, they don't have the resolution for mental issues to then that they have today. And I wonder sometimes, had it been a different time, would it had a different outcome? But my father worked very hard to support the family. They gave us everything we wanted. Everything we needed, and most of what we wanted. We were raised by aunts and uncles and neighbors, and, you know, back in those days, you basically said goodbye to your parents on Memorial Day, and you didn't see them again until Labor Day, and it was all okay. We grew up in the Park City's ghetto in Dallas, and it was a pretty safe place. What I can also share with you is it left a lot of room for myself and my brothers to fly under the radar. You could kind of get in between the authority, and so we played that to the hilt. And, you know, I never thought anything about it. We would all party, and, you know, everybody would make it home. But I noticed as we progressed, I would make it home okay. My older brother would make it home okay. My younger brother, not so much. And we went through a long period of time where the night would end either with a trip to the police station or Lou Sterrett for my dad, or the emergency room. And we had a family that we grew up with that we were all about the same age, and we all partied together. And, you know, it got to be quite a joke. We'd all go out partying on the weekends, and I would make it home just fine, and just about time I'd get to bed, the phone would ring. And I don't know what it is, but to this day, I can tell a phone from Lou Sterrett just by the ring. You know, and then you get the echo, you know. But really didn't think much of the consequences of it. And I just kind of thought that maybe if I could teach my brother how to pull back a little bit at the end of the night, he would be okay. So I commenced to try and parallel my partying with his partying to see if I could bring him down. And, you know, every time I'd hit the accelerator, he'd hit the brake. Every time I'd hit the brake, he'd hit the accelerator. And so finally, I just kind of started hanging in different circles. The consequences kept coming. And I remember one night, it wasn't, you know, I wished I could tell you that I was the good little saintly kid, but to be honest with you, we kind of used that to our advantage, my older brother and I especially, because my younger brother had this knack of bringing home the police department with him. And so I pretty well knew I didn't have to, you know, I didn't have to watch out coming home. I just had to make sure I got home after he did, because by that time, any policeman in the area was probably going to be occupied with him. And I remember a house sat on a corner, and I'd come driving in, and it was back in the days of the CB radios. And I'd come walking in, and you could look around the corner, and if you saw this little red, blue, red, blue, red, blue flashing in front of the house, I could turn right and wave off, or if there was nothing in front of the house, I could come on home, and it'd be pretty safe. And I'd get on the CB with my older brother, and, you know, we'd either say, it's safe, come on home, or wave off, wave off, wave off, you know. And I kind of used that to my advantage for a long time. And, you know, to me, it wasn't any big deal, but I could see my father wearing out fairly quickly. He worked long, hard hours to try and keep that family going financially. My mother stayed sick and never really got better and was bedridden most of her life. And So I could see it kind of wearing on him. And, you know, one of the fortunate things that I had growing up with the two brothers I did is they kind of set the bar low for me. All I had to do was stay out of jail and not wind up at the emergency room, and I was pretty golden. And I could figure out a way to do both of those things pretty well. Now, a lot of it was luck. There's a lot of circumstances in my partying where, you know, it could have just as easily gone the other way. But the one thing that I did know at the end of the night was I had to get home, and I knew when to stop. And I figured to myself, if I could figure that out, there's very little in my life that I could figure out. If I could figure that out, then anybody should be able to figure that out. And that's the mental attitude that I carried for a long time about my brother and his drinking. Back in the early 80s, my brother, I came home one night and there was a suitcase on the front porch with an envelope in it. And that was rather unusual. And I looked at the envelope and it had my brother's name on it. And my first reaction was, whew, okay, thank God. And what it had in it was a ticket, a plane ticket, and the note said, you can take the suitcase and the plane ticket and go to rehab, or you can take the suitcase, but you can't come in. And that seemed awfully cruel to me at the time. And so he went to go get his first $15,000 big book. And while he was up there, they had family visitation. And my father went to the family visitation, and he came back, and he started going to these meetings called Al-Anon, and I didn't know what Al-Anon was. But as he started doing Al-Anon, he did what the fellowship does. They engulfed him. They came into our home. They would play cards on Friday and Saturday night. I remember in high school and early college that I'd come home and the house would be just full of AAs and Al-Anons. And they were all cutting up and joking. And, you know, I thought it was fine. I kind of wished they weren't there because, you know, back in that time I was still partying. I graduated from high school and I went to college down in Nacogdoches. And I was down there for 2 years. I like to call them the lost years. It was the first time I'd been away from home. And I got pretty crazy down there. A lot of it I don't remember. One of the bright ideas I had when I got down there was that I would start a little sales and distribution deal going on. It didn't work out well for me at all. I was the one in charge of the inventory. And it's kind of like why I don't own a pizza place today. You know? So after 2 years of plying my trade very unsuccessfully down there and resolving it with a 1.1 grade point average, the dean of the college down there and the captain of the campus police decided it might be a good idea for me to achieve academia somewhere else. And honestly, it sounded like a pretty good idea to me. So I packed up everything I own in the world in my 77 Pinto wagon and hightailed it back to Dallas. And yeah, it was a pretty cool car. It had, you remember the old Super Tuners with the 8-tracks? That radio was bigger than the dashboard of the Pinto. And it had no reverse gear, so if I parked somewhere, I had to stick my foot out and push it back in neutral and get going again. Pretty cool little car, but I came back to Dallas. Well, while I was gone, things had progressed with what my brother was doing, and he did come back, and he tried AA, and AA didn't take to him. And so he was, at that time, on his way to get his second $15,000 big book. And he came back, and things were going fairly smooth for them. I had moved out of the house. I was going to school full-time and working in the family business. And I got a call from my father one night after he had come back, and apparently he had gone back out drinking. Well, he was out with his best friend drinking, and they had had an accident. And, you know, it wasn't that unusual. That call came quite often. But when I met him up at the emergency room of the hospital, and the family that we grew up with, who was his best friend and the daughter was my best friend, were standing around the emergency room, and there was something different this time. Everybody was very serious, and there was a noticeable presence of police officers in that emergency room. And the police officer pulled me and my father into a separate family room and had shared with us that the young man that was in the car with my brother had not been breathing since the accident. In all likelihood, he wasn't going to make it through the night, and this is what was going to happen. And I saw my father just crumble before my eyes. And we went upstairs. My brother was in surgery, and I remember sitting there, and I hear my father praying. And I scooted over to put my arm around him, and as I did that, I heard his prayer. And it was, "God, if you got to take one of them, take my son." And I remember thinking to myself, what in the world could ever make a father pray for the death of his son? And what I was to find out many years later is it was the disease of alcoholism. The boy lived for a couple of years, and he wound up passing away. And I got angry that night in the emergency room, and I stayed angry until I got to the rooms of Al-Anon several years later. Things kind of got calmed down after that because there were some serious repercussions that were going to happen legally. So, you know, he went back to AA. My father was going to Al-Anon, and I was out living on my own, not really caring too much about it. Well, in 87, I had been out of town in Austin celebrating my birthday with a friend I went to high school with. She and I would celebrate. We had the same birthday. So that next week, we were going to have a birthday party, and the family was going to come over, and my mom and dad were going to cook Lebanese food and everything. And I got up that morning, and I was driving over to my parents' house, and I stopped at different places along the way, friends of mine. You know, I basically grew up in the neighborhood I live in now. And when I finally left the last place and headed home, I got to my parents' house, and there was an ambulance and a squad car sitting in front of the house. Now, it wasn't unusual for me to see a squad car in front of the house. I mean, it just wasn't, but there were no lights on, and the two policemen were standing out there, and as I drove up and walked in, I looked at the officer, and I said, "What's wrong?" And he said, you need to go in there. And my first thought was, "Oh, God, Dad." And walked in there, and it was, "Oh, God, Mom." She had passed away in her sleep that night, and my brother was living at the house at the time and was there when it happened, and I'm so grateful he was, because my father was absolutely inconsolable. And she had basically passed away with him in the bed next to her, and he never knew it. He got up to start prepping the food and everything like that. And I just remember this overwhelming sense of panic that this man who I'd always looked up to was collapsing, and there was nothing I could do to stop it. And, you know, what do you say? It's all going to be okay? And it got kind of crazy because the family started showing up to the dinner, and, you know, as they realized what was going on, pretty soon we had a house full of relatives, and, you know, Mom's still back in the back, Dad's inconsolable. And then all of a sudden, these people start showing up who I remember seeing from the card games on Fridays and Saturday nights. And they walked in there, and they didn't say anything to them. And they grabbed coffee, and they sat next to him. And they would just make sure that his coffee cup was always full. And they would always make sure that he had Kleenex sitting there. And I watched this thing, and I was so incredibly grateful, but so incredibly jealous that these people were able to figure out what to do, and I didn't know. And they were his fellowship of AA and Al-Anon. I got to experience the fellowship of AA and Al-Anon in work, in my family, 7 years before I ever got to the rooms. It was pretty amazing. Got through that, and my brother, a year after that, fell in lust with this girl, and they had a little baby, and then they got married. And she had two kids from a previous marriage, and he was back out drinking again, and they were, as y'all may find this hard to believe, as sometimes happens with active alcoholism, they had come on some financial hardship. So they were living with my dad, and you know, I just remember how incredibly happy my father was to have those little, he always wanted grandkids. And, you know, I to that point had screwed up any relationship I had ever had any attempt at. My older brother had moved to Florida by this time. And so he was just loving life and his grandkids, and the kids' grandkids were loving him. And so they joked around, and I was working in the family business, and I was out there doing what I do. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I ever made anyone drink, and probably one of the best ways to phrase it, I'm going to borrow from a friend of mine in the program, Tom B. from Oklahoma. I never made anyone get drunk, but I sure made a lot of people thirsty. And, you know, it's not like I stood up in eighth grade and said on career day, I want to wreak havoc in every person's life that I love and that loves me, you know. But that's where it had come. And so we were jailing along in this 1990. I had come by to have dinner with my father. I would go by there two or three times a week, and, you know, we would go eat dinner or play gin rummy or something. And I walked in the door, and I couldn't find him. Joe and his wife and the kids were out. And I looked down, and my father was stooped over the coffee table, and he couldn't stand up. And he couldn't go down, he couldn't go up. So I called an ambulance, and the ambulance came and got him, took him to the hospital. And they ran him through a series of tests, and they came out, and they said, well, your father has lung cancer, and it's metastasized to his bones, and he's got very little time left. And now, I had had relatives that had cancer and fought it and beat it, and some didn't, but it was a long period of time. And I said, well, you know, what's the plan of action to fight this? And they said, weeks. And my whole world just collapsed. And I started those bullet prayers of, you know, God, I understand everybody dies, but you can't take them now. Not now. I was very angry that he was finally enjoying the gift of the grandkids and starting to enjoy his life, and all of a sudden this happened. And I said, if you'll just give us more time with him, give him more time with those kids, I'll do anything, anything. And he never came out of the hospital. A couple weeks later, he had just come out of radiation, and we were sitting up there, and he knew that he was getting bad quickly, and he looked over at me, and this is a man that had 10 years in the Al-Anon program, and he said, son, he said, take care of your brothers. And, you know, in retrospect, I wished he'd have asked me to bring peace to the Middle East. But by God, I had a mission. I finally had a purpose in life. I was going to take care of those brothers. And I didn't know for years after I came into the program why he said that. And I honestly and firmly believe to this day that he knew that I would try and do anything he told me to do, and that might create enough frustration for me to do something for myself. And it did. We broke into, he passed away. July 1st, my brother came up to me and he said, you know, as much grief as I've caused that old man, he'll probably die on my birthday. And my brother's birthday was July 16th. And I looked at him and I said, Joe, God doesn't work that way. like I know how God works, you know. I hadn't talked to the man in years until I find out my father's dying, and then he and I were on constant terms of conversation. Mostly I talked and expected him to listen. My father drew his last breath July 16th of 1990. And I remember waking up that morning and being at the hospital. And as I walked out that room, I looked up and I said, okay, gloves are off. And I will tell you, I went through 6 years of some of the roughest spiritual butt-whipping I've ever experienced. All self-imposed. We broke out into active alcoholism in the house. I had moved into the house because I thought we were going to take care of Dad for a while. I didn't know how long his cancer was going to progress or what the outcome was going to be. So I moved out of the apartment, moved into the house. So after he passed away, I'm living there with my brother, his wife, their three kids, and my brother in Florida, still in Florida. And we came up with the bright idea that what we would do with my brother in Florida's permission is to stay in the house, try and fix it up, and sell it. Now, I don't know what your experience is, but the family that I lived in active alcoholism didn't do a great job of fixing up that house. And it got bad. And I wished I could tell you everything they were doing, but what I can share with you is that I was just as crazy as anyone in that household. And, you know, there was a lot of fighting. We did what families in active alcoholism did. We fought. We yelled. We screamed. We cried. We laughed. We cried some more. We fought some more. And I just remember every day I would come home and you know, and at that time, when everybody said goodnight, it wasn't necessarily the end of the evening. And I was in a bedroom off of the kitchen, and the rest of them lived in the other side of the house. And I remember many a night, there'd be a knock on my door about 1 o'clock in the morning, and it'd be him. You know, if she'd just get off my back, if she'd just let me drink the way I want to drink, if she'd just leave me alone, we'd be fine. Okay, whatever, you know. Or it would be her. I'm going to leave them. I'm going to leave them. I didn't sign up for this. I'm going to pack up the kids and I'm going to leave them. Okay, you know. And then sometimes it would be the kids and they just wanted a quiet place to try and get some sleep. And I remember I'd set them up this pallet on the floor in my bedroom. And I mean, it was a little teeny tiny bedroom. And I'd plug Barney or something into the VHS. And they'd sit there and go to sleep, and I'd just sit there and stare at them, trying to figure out how in the hell it got this way, you know? And I'd get angrier and angrier and angrier. Well, in 1996, January of that year, unbeknownst to me, my sister-in-law had started going to some Al-Anon meetings. And I didn't know it. My brother didn't know it, but what I did notice almost immediately was a lot of the tension in the house started easing up. She was not nearly engaged in arguments like she had been, and when she backed off him, he got less angry. Things were going the way he liked it, you know. Things were quiet in the house, so I was a pretty happy camper. But then his disease progressed on him. And I remember I came home in February of that year, and my sister-in-law was there, and I noticed there was a lot of stuff missing from the house, namely my brother. And she said, well, I had a talk with your brother, and I told him that we're not going to live this way anymore, and we thought the best thing would be for him to leave instead of me packing up the kids and leaving. And I'm like, okay. So I go back to my bedroom, and I'm like, okay, so I'm living here with my sister-in-law and her kids, and my brother's gone, and I didn't know what to do. So I called my brother in Florida, and I said, look, we need to try and put something together on this house, get it sold. We'll get them some money to try and get set up on their own. Well, my brother made the decision after being gone for about a week that he would try AA again. And so he started going to meetings, and she was going to meetings, he was going to meetings, and Uncle David was babysitting the kids while they were going to meetings. Well, I can tell you, for 6 years I sat there and went, you know, if she'd get off his back, this family would be okay. If he quit drinking, this family would be okay. He had quit drinking, she got off his back, and Uncle David was Fruit Loops. I was bonkers. It was like I woke up and they changed all the rules on me. So I'm sitting there throwing all this anger and venom out of them, and this family that's trying to recover. And God love them, my brothers and sister-in-law's sponsors, you know, would come over and just kind of witness it all. And, you know, I'd sit there and I don't need you. I really don't. You know, if they're doing what I told them to do for 6 years, you know. And the reality was I was getting angrier and angrier and angrier, and I became very sarcastic. And it culminated for me, and I hit my bottom when I came home in July of 1990 from work. And at that time, my sister-in-law's sponsor had us all eating dinner as a family together. And I was helping my sister-in-law put the dishes together, and she started tearing up, and she goes, I want to share something with you. And she said, what you do with this is your own business. I'm not telling you how to live your life. But I need you to know that your 8-year-old nephew came up to me this evening in tears and wanted to know why his Uncle David hated him. And I had nothing. I had absolutely nothing. And I went off to my room and nothing. I get up the next morning and I'm sitting in there shaving and I'm looking and I can't stand what I see looking back at me in the mirror. And all that kept going on in my brain was, he wants to know why you hate him. He wants to know why you hate him. After a couple of weeks of there, I became willing to do anything to make that chatter go off in my head and try and, I don't know, make it right, leave, something. And I remember my sister-in-law saying to me, why don't you try Al-Anon? And I just went, because what came to my mind were those little needlepoint words as I came walking into my dad's birthday celebration. But I had no other answers. I really didn't. So I became willing to give it a try. So Monday, August 25th, I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting. And I walked in, and it was a huggy, greedy kind of group. I walked in, the first thing I noticed, there weren't any men in the group. And I'm like, okay, what's up with that? And as I'm walking in, I started negotiating with myself that maybe it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. And so I start backing up, and my sister-in-law, God love her, she's skinny as a rail, kind of tall, but I'm backing up, and she's standing behind me trying to block me from backing out of the door, and I'm winning that fight big time. And all of a sudden, this woman of very formidable proportions comes up to me, grabs me around the neck, and says, Uncle David, we've been waiting for you for months. Grabbed me around my neck, sat me down in the chair next to her, and put her arm around mine, and I couldn't budge. It was my sister-in-law's sponsor. So I sat through the meeting. I don't remember what was said that night. I do remember hearing in the opening that we who live or have lived with the problem of alcoholism understand as perhaps few others can. That stuck out. I didn't know it was alcoholism. I just figured Uncle David was crazy. I would have done anything to change the perception of my 8-year-old nephew. So I kept going to meetings, and you know, that first night I walked in and I was sharing with this at breakfast. I don't know anything other than God's grace that I came into the group I came into at the time I came in. That first night I'm sitting in there and this lady named Gracie comes walking up to me. And she grabs my hand and she just kind of pats it and she says, honey, I've been doing this for 32 years. And I kind of smiled and I said, to myself, she's not getting it. There's 12 steps, you know. I'm thinking 4 steps a week, I'm out of here in 3.5 weeks, I'm back to watching Monday Night Football, I'm golden, you know. And I think about her every time I'm sitting in a meeting and I hear someone go, well, I just need to check in. I'm so glad Gracie wasn't just checking in that night. Because after 32 years, she had stopped coming to meetings because she needed a meeting. She was coming to meetings to be there in case the next guy like me came walking in there that had no solution. I mean, my solution for years had been sitting in my room bouncing my opinion off of my opinion. That was my recovery program. And I'm so very grateful for that. We came into a very active group, and, you know, for several years, we were the recovering Mansoors. I mean, you know, we were there every Monday night, every Thursday night. Saturday night was open speaker meeting, and we'd go out for coffee afterwards. And I'll be honest with you, I wished I could tell you that it was all Shangri-La, but I could tell you that I struggled with it, and, you know, the person that was showing up to meetings was not the same person that was going back home that night. The only difference was now we'd all sit in the front room and sit there and yell and scream at each other, but instead of storming off to our rooms, everyone peeled off to a corner. And, you know, my brother would call his sponsor, my sister-in-law would call her sponsor. I got nobody to call, you know. And those kids were like, they didn't know what was going on. So after I'd been going to meetings for a little while, the ladies, God love them, they never said anything to me. I sat in the back row once they figured out I wasn't going to bolt out of there. One of the ladies used to come up and go, oh, honey, they call that the half measures row, you know. when you're sitting in meetings for months at a time and not sharing and everybody else is sharing, hell, even I noticed it, you know. So I wasn't dumb. I mean, I'd graduated from college, you know, took 5.5 years, but I did it. So I would start sharing what I thought those ladies needed to know about Al-Anon. You know, I would pontificate about my theory about the steps. And not a one of those ladies came up to me and said, you know, you don't know what you're talking about, keep your mouth shut. What they did was go out on a mission to find me a sponsor. And it was a fella that my sister-in-law had gone to a conference, and he had spoken there, and she came back with his. Back then, they were cassette tapes. They weren't CDs. And I listened to it, and the fellow's wife killed herself, burning up in a bed in a blackout. He had 2 little kids. I've never been married. I didn't have any kids, and he told my story on that cassette. And I went out to try and find him, and I couldn't find him, and I couldn't find him. He did a lot of traveling. And finally I said, okay, God, if I'm supposed to have a sponsor, I did my part, you know. 2.5 weeks later, I'm sitting in my home group, who this guy has never gone to. I had moved up to the second to the last row because I was getting better. I hear the door open behind me, and as we're introducing ourselves, you know, I came into a group that we use our last names within the fellowship, which our world service says we can do within the fellowship. And I'm glad we did, because I'd have had trouble finding the Hank T out there. Gets around, and all of a sudden I hear him introduce himself, and I whip my neck around, and he kind of jumps back a little bit. And afterwards, I asked him if he could please have coffee with me, and I see my sister-in-law in the corner going, you know. He agreed to be my sponsor, and my journey into the program of recovery began. You know, we're still having the fights at home, except now Uncle Dave's got a sponsor to call in the corner. You know? And I'll never forget this. He said, David, he said, I said, Hank, I can't be wrong all the time. I'll grant you, I'm not the best batter out there, but I can't be wrong all the time. He said, I'm going to give you 4 words that will change your life forever. Mind your own business. Mind your own business. He was right. He was absolutely right. Started through the journey of the steps. Had a real issue with the God deal. Was still very angry about all that with my dad. Because he had been my higher power. I just didn't know it. He said, the first thing you need to do is get a copy of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and read the first 164 pages. I said, Hank, I'm not an alcoholic. He said, David, that's great information. I need you to go get a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and read the first 164 pages. I hang up the phone. I said, if he thinks for 1 minute I'm going to go get a book written by a bunch of drunks, about a bunch of drunks, he's outside of his mind. So I'm sitting there reading the first 164 pages of my newly purchased big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the scales start peeling off my eyes. I start reading about the disease of alcoholism. I start wrapping my head around the fact that all those years that I would grab that brother by his neck and drive him around that block time after time after time and say, you're going to lose your wife, you're going to lose your kids, you're going to lose your job, you're going to lose your house, you're going to lose your truck, you're going to lose your brother, you're going to lose. And he'd say, I know, I'll do better, I'll do better. He meant it with every fiber of his being. He was in over his head. And once I started wrapping my head around that, I came to realize this is not a disease that love can fix. You know, had love been able to fix it, and I'm not talking about his disease, I'm talking about my disease. Had love been able to fix it, it wouldn't have been a problem to begin with. I started reading about this higher power. And what I can tell you is that it was not a quick process, but it was a journey well worth it. And my understanding of the God that I have today in my life came directly out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous as a member of Al-Anon. And I'll be forever grateful for that. The men I sponsor today, we worked the steps out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm not saying that the other literature is not great. I can only pass what I was given, the way I was given it. How was I going to make amends to this 8-year-old nephew? It really bugged me. First thing my sponsor told me is to start being the uncle that you want to be to him. So every Sunday night, he and I would go up to Brahms and get ice cream. There's nothing that says an amends has to be painful. I'm just saying, you know. But we started spending time together. And the fruit of that was I got a call. I had moved back out of the house a couple of years after I'd come into the program, and I got a call from my sister-in-law. And my nephew was having a mini meltdown because he missed his grandpa, Sheffy. He was 3 years old when Dad died. And Dad used to just make him the most special little kid in the world. He'd play cards with him. He'd let him win. My dad didn't even do that with me, you know. And I called my sponsor and I said, Terry's calling me. What should I do? He said, well, you know, it occurs to me, David, that he's having a problem with his grandpa Sheffy dying. He says, do you know anyone else that has a lot of problem with his grandpa Sheffy dying? I said, yeah. So I picked him up and we went to the cemetery and we visited with Grandpa Sheffy for about 2.5 hours. That was the best I could do at the time. I still was not able to tell him I was sorry the way I felt he deserved it, but I was only able to communicate at his level of understanding. My sponsor assured me if there's more to be done, God will provide for it. Started sponsoring men, started getting busy, started going to conferences. I will tell you that it's been my experience as a member of Al-Anon that at every corner and turn of my recovery, the hand of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous has been extended to this member of Al-Anon. Sometimes that's just been in the form of going out for coffee after meetings. Sometimes it's going to big book study breakfasts in a sponsorship line I don't belong in. they started sending me up to Lake Murray Men's Conference. And I guess at this time I'd been in the program going on 8.5 years. And I would stay up there. And the first time I went up there, usually my sponsor and I were the only two Al-Anons up there, at least the only two that would admit they were an Al-Anon. My hat's off here. This is amazing. But, you know, I would visit with the guys, and we'd sit in meetings and got to know the guys. And, you know, there's a lot of... I got a call one night from a guy that I've known in AA for many years, and he called me up, and he'd heard me tell my story. And he said, David, he says, I got a young man that I'm working with, and I don't know if he can stay sober in that house he's living in. Because he'd heard me talk about being that black cloud over the recovery that was trying to go on in my home and how I was sabotaging that. I don't know how God takes what I was doing and provides it to be a useful tool to somebody else. But I can tell you, I was up there at a conference, and usually my sponsor and I stay in the same room there in the lodge. He backed out at the last minute. He had a health issue come up. So I go up there, and I'm in the lodge, and I'm unpacking. And one of the guys from ODAT in Plano knocks on my door, and he says, David, he says, I understand that your sponsor's not coming up. I said, yeah, that's right. He says, you got an extra bed? And I said, absolutely, I do. He says, I got a young man I've been working with for about 4 months, and we need a place for him to stay. I said, absolutely, tell him to come down. So I'm finishing unpacking. There's a knock on the door. I go open the door, and staring back at me, that 8-year-old nephew is now 19 and has 4 months of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how that happens. The best I can come up with today is that God uses the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon to put families back together that this disease just wreaks havoc in. And I wish I could tell you he got sober and it was nirvana and life was great, but I can tell you this much. After he and I spent time that weekend, it's never, ever, ever going to be a question in his mind ever that his Uncle David loves him. I just know how to love him healthy today. That's all. I didn't cause it. I can't cure it. I can't control it. I need to make damn sure I'm not contributing to it. That's my part of it. As a matter of fact, he got married a couple of years ago. He's been sober for a few years now, and he started his own business. And he called me the other day, and he goes, they're going to have a baby in June. And I keep trying to say that, you know, I'm just saying David's an awfully nice name. Whatever. But he calls me to tell me how he's doing, and he calls me to tell me that the baby's just, he heard the heartbeat, and it's vital, and it's strong, and it's, and, you know, and it's just, it's so different than I don't know back in 1996 that I could have ever looked ahead and seen the relationship that I have with that young man today and hopefully will have with his family. You know, what it's like today, I stay busy. You know, my sponsor tells me when I call moaning and groaning, he says, hey, bud, you know, thinking bad about yourself, still thinking about yourself. Thank you, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You know? There's been a lot of, you know, the miracles are on a daily basis. I don't know that I can sit there and say this miracle and that miracle. It's a miracle today that I have a relationship with my family. It's a miracle today that I can love you in a healthy way. You know, my idea was love, and what I saw was if you love someone, you take care of them. Now, whether they want to be taken care of was of a little consequence. By God, if I loved you, I was going to take care of you. Ruined every relationship I ever had. You know, those years during the active alcoholism, I was giving marriage counseling. I was giving child-rearing counseling. Never been married, don't have any children. You know, that's where my best thinking got me. Life is good today. life is very good today. I want to share with you one thing that I just walked through, and it was, it's hard. My brother in Florida was diagnosed with cancer when he was 40, colon cancer, and they got it all, and he was in remission for 13 years. Well, about 2.5 years ago, it came back. And he's been battling it for a couple of years now, and he lost that battle in December. And I went down there in October, and I'm long past the point in my relationship with my higher power that I ask him not to take people. That's not my job. So when I went to visit him in October, I said, God, let me be of service to him, and let me focus on his life and not him dying. And God answered yes to both of those. And I had three of the most wonderful days. He and I laughed and cried and talked about stuff we didn't want to talk about, but we talked about it. The plan was I was going to go back in January and spend some more time, but in a period of about 2.5 weeks, he went from 6 months to 3 months to 1 month to weeks to days to minutes to he was gone. And I'm sitting in there in Florida with his wife and their kids, and I can promise you active alcoholism is alive and well in Florida. Just kind of shaking my head, looking at him in that box and trying to figure out, you know, how this happens. And all of a sudden, my phone just goes ballistic. And I look down, and it's text message after email from women I've been sitting in meetings with for the last 19 years, from men that I have the pleasure to work with on a daily basis. And I got this oversense feeling that I buried a family member that day. But through the program of Al-Anon and the fellowship of AA, I've got a family that can never be taken away from me. I'm the only one that can screw that up. And the price is too high to pay for me to do that. Close real quick with something my father used to share with me. We'd go see Mom at the cemetery, and he'd sit there and focus on the mausoleum wall for hours and hours and hours. One time I had to ask him, what are you looking at? He said, I'm looking at the dash, son. I said, the dash? He said, yeah. He said, her name, day she was born, dash, the day she died. He said, it was the dash that was the beautiful part of your mom, son. And what I can tell you is today I got a dash I wouldn't trade for anything because of folks like you in rooms like these and the opportunity to come and share a weekend like this. This is an amazing deal, and I will be back. Thank you.